state and city demands. And so with that, we are completely out of time. I really do want to thank very much Alberto Moreno and Ramon Ramirez for joining us this morning for this discussion.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both for your work.
And please do check out the Positively Revolting Facebook page for links to resources and actions coming up. We'll be back next week with oh so much more.
There comes a time when every second, every day.
Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This month, because of the membership drive, the Program Advisory Committee will meet Tuesday, February 21st at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Seed to Table Supper Event to benefit Cully Community Clinic on Saturday, February 25th at 5 p.m. at the Side Yard Farm and Kitchen in Portland. Chef Stacy Givens will host a seed-to-table dinner array with herbal cocktails and wine. This supper event will support Seasonal Wellness Clinic and the rehabilitation of its trailer and to stock the clinic with supplies. Again, that's the seed-to-table supper event to benefit Cully Community Clinic on Saturday, February 25th at 5 p.m. at the Side Yard Farm and Kitchen. 4800 Northeast Simpson Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is amazing. Thank you so much. We made our goal and it was all thanks to you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for supporting KABU during our recent membership drive. You guys did great. This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01, and coming up at 10, it's going to be Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and then at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. 11 o'clock, Radio Zine has an interview with Jenny Monet, independent writer and journalist who was embedded and arrested at Standing Rock. Then a look at the film, I'm Not Racist, Am I? But first, we have the vets ready to come to you live. Angie and Marvin, Vet's Voice, coming up in just mere moments. Thanks for tuning in to KABU today.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run. Finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, and 104.3 FM Corvallis, Albany. And you can also hear KBOO on the World Wide Web at kbo.fm. And you can also hear some of our older shows at kbo.fm/Veterans Voice. And also, Angie puts a lot of wonderful stuff on Facebook. So you just go to Veterans Voice Radio Show on Facebook, and Angie's always got good stuff on there. And I'm Marvin. I'm here with Angie.
Hello.
And today we're going to have a guest in just a little bit. They're calling him right now, and Angie will talk about him when we finally get there. And I want to talk just a little bit about back, when was it, Angie? January 20th, wasn't it?
How could you ever forget that date?
Yeah. My brother and I went down to Pioneer Square to the rally down there, and it was just huge amounts of people, just amazing. And the rally started and then started to march. And as we went around, I was kind of in the front, on the side, on the front with them. And we started going down. Okay, great. And so we started going down the street, and then they made a turn to go up the Burnside Bridge. And as we got to the Burnside Bridge, I kind of got pushed over by the walkway. There's like these stairs up to the Burnside Bridge. I was like, got pushed over by there, and I was standing there. And I looked at it, and one of the things that Ted Wheeler, the supposed mayor of Portland, said that they're not going to stop the traffic on the bridge. Remember, he said that was one of his big things. Well, they had cops on the west side of the bridge and cops on the east side of the bridge stopping the traffic. I mean, there was no traffic anyway because they'd stopped it, you know. It was just like a big slap in our faces, you know. Like, we're not going to let you do something. We're going to show you. And so what had happened there, when they got up there and got in front of the cops, people, you know, you're going to holler at the cops. Of course you're going to holler at them. And here they are looking like star troopers and everything like that. And I was standing on the side, and I was looking down the line of the cops and the people, and I never saw one physical contact at all. And they fired a tear gas at us, you know. And they hit this one couple of guys, people right in the face, man. And they, you know, they instantly went down. And there was no reason for them to do that. There was nothing. That started the whole problem. When they did that, things just went out of control. But I got gassed, and my brother was with me. And he kind of got down on the little staircase there. And I said, I'm not getting down. These guys, that's not right. And so I stayed up there, you know, talking to the cops, you know, about how crazy they were for doing that. We didn't do anything. And they hit us with pepper spray. Remember, they hit us with pepper spray like four or five times, you know, as we were going around the city downtown. And they hit us with pepper spray, and they hit us with tear gas, you know.
And the chalk bullets, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk about that just a minute. And so they sprayed us with pepper spray. They sprayed us with tear gas, and that's nothing but chemical warfare. That's chemical warfare against the citizens of Portland and the citizens of Oregon. And Ted Wheeler is the mayor, and he's in charge of the police, you know? So the buck goes right to him. And not only did they do that, they hit us with the tear gas and the pepper spray. They also hit us with flash and bang grenades. And that is nothing more than a cluster munition, because when they hit those at us, they would hit the ground, explode, and throw out these other ones that would bang, you know? And as I was turning, I saw them start to fire those, so I turned a little bit and started to go back towards the square, and they fired it off, and one went off about 10 feet from my ear, you know? And my ear started ringing, and I have tinnitus from Vietnam anyway, so my ear started ringing, and it rang for about 10 minutes, and another one hit by my brother's foot, you know? And that's cluster munitions, you know? That's just not right, you know? Ted Wheeler's the mayor, and he's responsible for the police, and they're using chemical warfare and cluster munitions against the citizens of Oregon. And Angie just brought up the bullets.
The chalk bullets.
Yeah, tell them what that is.
Well, they're small round bullets that are filled with chalk that hit you.
Yeah, they hit you.
and the police are able to use their monopoly on violence against you.
Yeah, they... When they were firing those, they also, I think they used rubber bullets too down there. And I think those rubber bullets are also a cluster munition. When they hit and then they open and they spray these bullets out, these rubber bullets out. And so they were firing that. And none of this would have happened because they started that whole mess right there on the Burnside Bridge. I mean, they had the west end blocked. They had the east end blocked. So there was no traffic. It was just a slapping, you know, people's faces, you know. Wheeler says, oh, we're not going to let them take the bridges. Well, they blocked the bridges anyway. Nobody got over them. And then they fired chemical warfare at us with this pepper spray, and they did cluster munitions against us, you know. They fired, Angie, one time, I lost you.
Well, you know, I ended up getting gassed, and... I'm not saying this to make myself sound heroic. I'm saying this because this is an event that happened. I was pushing somebody away from the police in a wheelchair.
Yes, I remember that.
While getting tear gassed.
Right. And also one of those, because right after you was pushing them, and I turned around and I started pushing, there was two of them. And one of them got hit in the back. I don't know if it was from the flashing bangs or what. Two people in wheelchairs got hit in the back. And one woman, as I stepped up on the Pioneer Square, there's one woman had been knocked down and her face was bloody. Her nose was all bloody. And it was just horrible, you know. And none of that had to happen because nobody was doing anything. Nobody was doing anything. When they started that fight, they started by putting tear gas on the Burnside Bridge, and that started the whole mess. And the rest of the night was them firing at us with, you know, chemical warfare and cluster munitions the whole night, you know. And it was just you know, that they started that fight. And when I get the chance, I'm going to talk to Wheeler about that, because he's in charge of that, and he allowed them to fire chemical warfare and cluster munitions against the citizens of Portland and the citizens of Oregon. And that's just not right. That's just definitely not right. What else do we got to say, Angie? Is Jonathan on the phone? Okay, I'll let Angie introduce him.
Well, we have Jonathan with us today, and he is somebody that I met at a progressive leadership training. And I'm really happy to be able to have him on. And he's the author of this really awesome book.
Yes, great.
Both Marvin and I read it. Anti-War Soldier, How to Dissent Within the Ranks of the Military. It's so educational, and it's a really easy and small book to read. So it's not like you're committing to like this 500-page book. It's packed full of stuff.
I mean, great.
You can read this in a weekend.
Yep.
And he's a Navy veteran, and he is also has worked on so many different things. And maybe we can just bring him in right now. Jonathan, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Angie, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Yes, glad you're good. With us today.
Thank you. Glad you all can have me. Yes, thanks. Thanks for the invitation.
Go ahead, Angie.
Yeah, so I just want to introduce you a little more. You're the coordinator of Prince George's County, Maryland People's Coalition. You're an organizer, an activist, and you've worked on what's called the Appeal for Redress. And I'd really like to start with just how you ended up joining the military to begin with, because your story is different than some other stories that I've heard in which you joined the military already with a degree, which is kind of rare.
And older. You were older.
Yes, yes. I was a little older than your traditional recruit. I was 3 months shy of my 27th birthday.
Wow.
And yes, I did have my bachelor's degree in political science from Howard University, and had worked at a couple of nonprofits, the ACLU and Amnesty International. But in terms of my personal situation, I became a full-time single dad early part of 2003, and that lifestyle was no longer amenable to working the type of work I had been working at a nonprofit, doing social justice work. And so I attempted to transition to teaching, but that didn't go so well. It was going through a 3-week crash course to be a certified teacher. So I saw the Navy. I didn't go in as a lifer at all. And there's nothing about my background that would have had me think about a lifelong commitment to the Navy. But I did see it potentially as a bridge towards A, paying down some of my student debt from undergrad. Had about maybe $47,000 worth of debt in terms of student loans. But then also financing my graduate education. I was looking at graduate education opportunity. And so I didn't see it as something that was a lifelong commitment, but I saw it as a transitional period in my life. And so based on the circumstances that I was faced with at that time, this was fall of 2003, I took the plunge and enlisted in the United States Navy.
That really speaks to how much an economic stronghold can affect somebody's life.
Oh, no question about it. Yeah, no question about it. I was one of those young people who I would describe myself as someone who dreamed and envisioned themselves beyond their circumstances. You know, I got to Howard University fall 1995. My roommate, Christopher Wingfield, a good guy, but he and I definitely, just by demeanor, certainly were trained in different ways for the college environment. I mean, Chris was a prep school kid. I was a public school kid, for example. I mean, Chris' family was financing his education. I financed my own. In fact, I only had enough money to go to Howard University for 1 year.
Mm. Wow.
Spent my senior year of high school engaged in a lot of different contests, activities, whether that was oratorical contests, essay contests, scholarship competitions, because that was my dream, to go to Howard University. And when it was all said and done, when I graduated high school in 1995, I had about a little over $6,000 in outside scholarships in my hand, which was just enough money to cover the gap between what was offered to me in financial aid and what the university said my bill was. But my mother instilled this faith in me that if I got on the campus of Howard University, if I actually made it to the campus, that I would find a way to stay. And she was absolutely right about that. Herself being an HBCU graduate, historically Black college and university graduate of Clark College, now Clark Atlantic University in Atlanta, Georgia. So with that faith instilled in me, that's what I rode with. And I was successful at matriculating, but also really embracing every aspect of the university life, particularly the student activist life, student movement may lure at the campus. So
talk about when you joined the Navy, talk about what you did and talk about the first, you seem to be doing fine, and then some things happened that kind of changed that. So can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, what your job was when you finally went on the ship, right? Was it on the ship where the problem started?
I think it was actually before that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so going into the Navy, I look at it in three stages, right? So the first stage was boot camp. And really, really before that, the first stage was going to...
maps and all that.
Actually talking to a recruiter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where they actually sell you all the good stuff. But I didn't trust any of it. I was very, very meticulous about what I needed in my contract, particularly the student loan repayment,
mm-hmm.
which they didn't have in my contract at first. And I said, no, you all have it because I researched it.
Of course they said that.
And then you go to boot camp, right? And so that process was interesting. And because once you go through MEPS, I don't remember what the acronym MEPS stand for, but that's the processing aspect, you know, where they, you know, last-minute checks, year analysis, all that kind of stuff. But once you get to the airport, before you get to Great Lakes, Great Lakes, Michigan is where Navy boot camp is. That's where the games begin, for lack of a better phrase.
You mean Illinois, right?
Yeah. What did I say, Michigan?
Yeah.
You were traumatized.
Yeah. You probably blocked it out.
Is it on both sides of the state, though? It might be.
Well, maybe. Is it Michigan? Maybe. I didn't even know where I was, I guess. I was at the same one. There's only one Navy boot camp.
Right.
Oh, yeah. But
once you get to the airport to fly over there, that's where the games begin. That's where they start to really pay attention to you. They're looking for little things about you. Like, how do you respond to a command or order? Do you ask too many questions? They're looking to weed people out before you even get there. And then once you get to boot camp, what I remember about that first night we got there was getting off that bus, and they run us into this building. And, I mean, that's where the petty officers, those people that are in charge, they begin to just break people down based on their hair, based on their look. I remember one guy asked me, why are you here? Did you just get out of jail? You know?
Ooh,
wow.
One other guy was, he must have had purple hair, had his hair dyed. They asked him, excuse my language, who the F is your recruiter?
Wow.
I mean, you know, it's... And then I never heard so many West Virginia jokes in my life. I mean, from a class perspective, a geographical perspective, from an anti-LGBTQ perspective, certainly the racial aspect. I mean, all of it. I mean, so there's two types of dehumanization that's going on. But the first dehumanization you go through is the dehumanization of yourself, you know, to actually dehumanize you. And then once they dehumanize you and break you down, now they got to dehumanize the other, whoever that enemy is, you know, that's out there,
mm-hmm.
that we're supposed to be fighting and annihilating. So boot camp had that ideological piece to it. But then once I got to A school, so boot camp is 9 weeks, and I survived boot camp. I was not an exemplary recruit, but I also wasn't,
A mess up
what the Navy calls a dirt bag. I did exactly what I needed to do to get out of there. And then once we got to apprentice school, now that's where I would say the profiling began at apprentice school. This is where you learn your job. So my job, I came into the Navy as a photographer's mate, PH. And the school that trains the media ratings for the military is at Fort Meade, Maryland. It's called Defense Information School. And this is where the targeting began. This is where the profiling.
Hello?
Hello, are you there?
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I have a habit of stopping just to make sure you all are good.
That seems like a veteran thing to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but I'll continue. In terms of the profiling, what started it was the first day, right? Because they asked a question in class. They asked, basically what motivated us to join the United States military. When it got to me, I said that at this point in my life, you know, based upon what I considered to be a late 20s mini crisis of sorts, and really being the type of person that didn't have, although I'm a university graduate, I didn't have the same type of safety net, I would say, that probably my contemporaries.
Mm-hmm.
I was essentially a working class student going to school in a non-working class environment, which is really interesting.
Mm.
So I said that I view the Navy as being, but I didn't say the Navy, I actually said the military, as being the best affirmative action employer in the country. That's what I said.
Mm.
And it's true, even though they won't admit it. It's actually true to a certain degree. But the fact that I used the term affirmative action immediately made me a target, like immediately.
Wow. I remember that part in your book that didn't surprise me, though.
Yeah.
You know, that didn't surprise me.
Right.
That made you kind of a target because they do not like anything like that. The military industrial complex in general.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. So, yeah, so extra counseling chits, that's what they call them, counseling chits. Write-ups for everything. I mean, if I was a second late for class, written up. You know, if I looked at somebody wrong, written up.
Wow.
Written up. I mean, somebody had 20 write-ups during my time. But then what I thought was interesting was how they attempt to use not only the chain of command, but the African-American members of the chain of command. Because there was this one situation where they brought in this senior chief, E8, a lady who just, reamed me out, meaning cursed me out.
Mm-hmm.
Or it said to me, do you want to get sent out to the fleet undesignated, which is the worst thing to happen to a sailor, is to actually get sent out to the fleet without a job. But if you get sent out there undesignated, then you're just on a ship, chipping paint, doing all types of, just doing the lowest level work they can find.
Yep.
So I made the best out of A school. Actually, because I was close to the neighborhood, the community, the county that I've been organizing in for a number of years, Prince George's County, Maryland, where I live today, I was able to get some of my shipmates involved in local organizing for police accountability against police brutality. That was pretty good. And we were able to stand up on a few issues while we were in apprentice school. So that was good as well. And then from there, after 13 weeks, I left to go to the ship. I left early July 9th, 2004, and I arrived at the USS Theodore Roosevelt on July 26, 2004.
Yeah, the thing that is really interesting is just how little people in the military know about their rights. And I learned a lot just from reading your book about the different things that, cause I didn't actually really know that you could even protest in the US military, as long as you were off duty, that you were not in uniform and that you were not, in a place that was supposedly going to be violent or something like that. At that time, I know that now, but when I was in the military, I just thought protesting, you were not allowed to do that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a pretty common thing for people in the military to not have any idea about. So can you talk about the incident where somebody actually brought a noose?
Oh, yeah. Talk
and
about that.
And that pretty much kind of stemmed that seemed to kind of unravel quite a bit of this stuff that happened.
What's it? Yeah, go ahead, because that interests me in your book also.
Right, gotcha. Yeah, so in terms of the shop where I worked on the ship, there was a first-class petty officer in our shop named James Fell, E6, Lead Petty Officer, LPO. I would never forget that guy as long as I live, because he exemplified everything about the Navy that I just found repulsive. You know, he was belligerent. He was arrogant. He was hierarchical.
Mm-hmm.
He was a tyrant.
White guy.
White male, blonde hair. Yeah, mm-hmm. He was a tyrant. He certainly was culturally a racist. No question about that. But see, that's a given, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that, I mean, the military kind of breeds and promotes that type of behavior and thinking too.
Right, right. But I think what was so appalling to me was the way in which he treated people in the shop, the cursing people out, the screaming people out, and the chain of command always backing him up.
Oh yeah,
always backing him up. So I took the plunge. I challenged them. You know, I took them before equal opportunity on an issue. Equal opportunity actually agreed with me on this particular issue for him keeping me with a situation where we had came back from a workup, and he kept me out to work on purpose. Let everybody else go, but kept me out to work. So I challenged it. But then what ended up happening is, because I had the nerve to challenge him, then the same thing that happened to me at the apprentice school started happening to me in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
But man was having this extra focus on me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a situation where I got snowed in New York City and couldn't get back to the ship on time, where the chain of command threw the kitchen sink at me. And took me before a DRB. They call it a disciplinary review board. It should be called the draconian review board.
Yeah, I remember that. It's good.
Totally draconian in terms of you know, them screaming me out and really trying to drive me over the edge.
Well, and even people who have survived a sexual assault have to do that. They have to stand at attention in front of senior enlisted people, stand at attention, and that goes in your record as a disciplinary action against you.
Wow.
That's how it's still handled.
Yes,
disgusting.
But, yeah, that's horrible. So you got snowed in New York. You called and told them that you're snowed in and you'd get back to the ship as fast as you could, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And discipline, as you already know, is very arbitrary. So, I mean,
right.
Of course, in most situations, this stuff is handled at the lowest level possible. That's what they teach, right? But not in my case. But that was a situation where I almost went to captain's mess, but it stopped at the XO, and I got what was called 24 hours of extra military instruction. Now, this happened in like the spring of, well, January, February of 2005.
Dang.
And so for a year, I pretty much kind of kept my head low and just did what I had to do. So I'm bringing you up to the news incident because I continue to document offenses. And at one point in the fall of 2005, I was told by the senior enlisted leadership that it wasn't the offenses I was pointing out that was the problem. I was the problem.
Whoa.
It was me that was the problem because I wouldn't internalize the military culture. And that led to the incident you all asked me about, the noose incident, where January 2006, we're off the coast of Iraq, January 10th, 2006 to be exact. And these petty officers in our photo lab pull out a hangman's noose in front of my face.
Oh,
I'll never forget that as long as I live. But then again, I'm not trained to see myself as a victim. I'm a fighter. But at this point, I had lost total faith in my chain of command in the shop. And so I wrote a letter to the admin officer, CC, the command master chief, who's the highest enlisted person on the ship, to CC the entire chain of command, including the Equal Opportunity Advisor and the Equal Opportunity Officer, and an investigation was started pronto. There was a naval officer, a commander that led the investigation. He decided to do a survey of the shop to see what the climate was. And I was surprised that at least a third of those surveyed, a cross-section, both in terms of enlisted rank. We even had one E6, a first class, who supported it. And in terms of race, it was multiracial in terms of the support. There was one young lady who also raised a lot of the gender issues because of a lot of this sexual harassment situation. They would put pictures of her up on the shop doing all sorts
of man.
Sex and stuff like that. So all this stuff came to the surface. And when they found that, you know, the investigation, the legal language, I believe, folks were liable, or that my act, or that what I put forth was true. Now, a year later, my entire chain of command is going to Caps Mass. Now imagine that.
Wow.
They got to go to Caps Mass.
Wow.
Well, I'm going to just break in here for a second. You're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 9.7 FM here in Portland. And we're talking to Angie. You want to introduce him again?
Yeah, this is Jonathan Hutto. That's how you pronounce your last name, right?
Hutto.
Jonathan W. Hutto Sr. And it's spelled H-U-T-T-O. And his book is Anti-War Soldier, How to Dissent Within the Ranks of the Military.
Very good book, I want to tell you. It's very good.
Really
book.
Good.
Yeah. And so after they did the... they brought that noose. Was that the same blonde-haired guy that had been giving you trouble that brought the noose?
No, it wasn't him, James Fickle. No, it wasn't him. He was off the ship by then. He had already transferred to another command.
Yeah. How many people were in your shop?
How many people were in my shop? Or, you mean total?
Yeah. Do you know?
The total shop. This is the media shop. It could be probably somewhere between maybe 30, 35, maybe.
Both men and women?
Yeah, men and women. Uh-huh.
Okay, and that's the shop that they brought the survey through.
Yes.
Okay, I was a little confused about that.
Wow.
And so then they took you to Captain's Mass, and then what happened there?
Well, it went all the way to Captain's Mass. The XO, the executive officer. Had what was called Executive Officers Inquiry, XOI. You have to go there before you go to Captain's Mass.
Oh.
And what was interesting is that after the noose incident, you know, I was the one that went back to the fold and untied the noose and put it in my locker in where I was sleeping. Right before XOI, the senior chief, now this is the same senior chief that told me that I was the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their senior chief then asked me for the noose before the XOI because he said he wanted to present it as evidence. Now, you can already see you know, the conflict here, right? Now, he's going to represent me. In my mind, I'm thinking he's going to take the noose and throw it away somewhere or burn it.
Yep.
So it's evidence. So, no, what I did was I took the noose and took it straight to the XO's office and put it on his desk.
Ah, good for you.
So, but when they asked me where was the noose, I said I gave it to the XO. So even though the XO ruled in my favor and sent the entire chain of command to Captain's Mass, I was written up by my chain of command for insubordination and not following a command by giving them the noose.
Oh, that's typical, isn't it?
That's absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
But so we got through XOI. We then got to Captain's Mass. And what happened was, The perpetrator, the E4, who was a perpetrator, his name was Edmund Boothby, was his last name, Boothby.
White guy.
He was punished with reduction in rank, so he went down from like an E4 to E2.
Mm.
And
wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, and then he
wow.
It's an E4 to E2, and then. So much money was supposed to have been taken out of his check, but there was what they did, a suspended bus where they say half month's pay times two, but suspended pending good behavior or something like that.
Oh, okay. He was a white guy?
But both guys were white.
Both guys are white. Okay.
But the one guy who was the military officer in charge in that situation. The way the military works, and Angie knows this, right? But both of y'all know this. Whoever's got the highest rank, they're supposed to get the heaviest hit.
Right.
And in this situation, that's not what happened. The lowest ranking guy got the heavy hit. You know, he got reduced in rank, E-40, E-2. But the other guy didn't get any reduction in rank or pay. They stated it, but then it said suspended bus pending good behavior. I wasn't satisfied with that myself.
Yeah, I can see why.
So you ended up in January 2006, you ended up getting the book Soldiers in Revolt by David Courtwright.
Great book.
Can you talk about where that book led and some of the things you learned in that and how that kind of morphed into the development of the appeal for redress?
Yes. Yeah, so Soldiers in Revolt, a professor of mine, an old professor friend of mine from Howard University sent me that book. It was the 30th anniversary copy. The late Howard Zinn wrote the prelude to it. And I was just, I was totally blown by it, motivated by it, moved by it, inspired by it. Because one of the things that I unconsciously did or understood then that I consciously understand firmly now is this sense of agency that we have as people. And so what Soldiers in Revolt did was reaffirm that sense of agency that within the military, in this situation, when I'm off the coast of Iraq, when I'm involved in a struggle against racism and xenophobia and intolerance in my shop, that we have influence. And in fact, there's even a power that we have if we tap into it. And so the stories were just motivating me from, military folks organizing on their bases. David Courtwright specifically organizing an actual lawsuit against the Vietnam War.
Yeah, he did.
You know, about the ad that was taken out in New York Times to do the troops come out against the war. That history of the Vietnam War was pretty much unknown to me. I mean, the history that I knew, that I grew up understanding, was the history of folks, you know, heroic people like Julian Bond, like Muhammad Ali, like Dr. King and others, and about the anti-Vietnam movement itself, particularly the veterans movement, you know, VA.
Can you talk about the Stop Our Ship movement and how and also how equal opportunity actually came about in the military?
Right, so Stop Our Ship, SOS.
I think that's really important for people to hear.
Yeah.
I see the Stop Our Ship movement was the Constellation out on the West Coast, I believe. I believe it was in San Diego. I may have the name of the ship wrong.
It's the Coral Sea. Is it in your book?
The Coral Sea? Okay, you got my book right there. I don't have my book in front of me.
I have my little underlined favorite parts.
Yeah, her book's underlined.
Hey, but no, the Stop Our Ship movement was... And you can see all of this on a documentary, Sir No Sir, David Spiegel's documentary. But the Stop Our Ship movement was when sailors actually organized to stop their ship. They actually not only petitioned on the ship, but they actually had a mock election where actual citizens within the town itself actually voted and voted overwhelmingly for the ship not to be deployed.
Yeah.
In terms of how a lot of the reforms came about within the chain of command at that time. There was an admiral by the name of Zumwalt.
Yeah, Admiral Zumwalt.
Yeah, Admiral Zumwalt, who was seen, he was a young admiral. He must have got appointed CNO at the age of 49.
Yeah, he was great.
Okay, I have a correction. You were right about the Constellation as well as the Coral, the Hancock, and the Ranger.
Right,
I was gonna say that.
I thought it was a Constellation. That's
yeah. It's all of those ships.
Yep.
I just want to correct that. Anyways, moving on.
Also, go ahead.
The Admiral Zumwalt, looking at the environment that was taking place within the Navy at that time, which was a microcosm of what was happening in the military at that time in terms of just the enlisted ranks being, if the right word is, infested.
Mm-hmm.
We're just sick and tired of being sick and tired of war.
Yep.
Attitude, demeanor, outlook. Zumwalt saw that environment as an opportunity to potentially bring in some reforms that were being demanded from the enlisted ranks as a way of saving the military, really saving the Navy, to be honest with you. So equal opportunity councils, rap sessions on the mess decks with black and white sailors, you know, allowing folks, you know, to wear their afros, wear you know, smoke on the ship, you know, but things that, but some, a lot of those reforms didn't last, but some of them did. And one of the most lasting of those reforms is to this day still having equal opportunity advising officers within the chain of command of the Navy. Yeah. That was itself was a critical reform. If even if looking at my own time in the Navy, it's very critical.
Mm-hmm. Admiral Zumwalt's son was in Vietnam. I think he was on riverboats, and he died from Agent Orange.
Right, I read that.
Yeah, Admiral Zumwalt's son, Junior, died from Agent Orange. And Zumwalt was in charge of the whole Pacific area.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that he allowed guys to grow their hair a little longer. They could have mustaches. Mm-hmm. And it really changed when Admiral Zumwalt took over.
Wow.
Yeah.
So can we, let's talk about your contact with David Courtwright and how that started to form this appeal for redress.
Okay, so yeah, when I was reading the book Soldiers in Revolt, and again, very well researched, there's a part in the book towards the back where he lays out a program for what would sustain the GI movement. And he was saying essentially that, you know, peace and justice organizations have got to organize amongst the active duty.
Yep.
They actually got to organize amongst active duty and build a sustained force of activism within the military based on the DOD regulations that would support that. So it was based on that I wrote David. I was just on the computer one day, found where he was. He's a professor at Notre Dame University, the Kroc School of Peace Studies.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote David, told him, hey, I'm an active duty sailor and, you know, love to connect with you. He emailed me back immediately. We began a conversation, and I told David that I had an idea of bringing him to Norfolk, that my ship would be back in port around March, and that we could do something in the spring. And so I worked on it. When I got back on the ground, I connected with local peace and justice organizations on the ground, BFP. I was very active in the area. In fact, one of the current board members of VFP now, Tom Palumbo, was the VFP representative on the ground, head of the VFP organization. And I forgot with him,
mm-hmm.
a couple of organizations. And we did a program at the local YWCA, very well attended. And we had maybe a dozen, maybe as much as maybe 15 active duty persons that was there. And so after we had the meeting at the YWCA, we then had a smaller meeting at a local professor's house with just the active duty and David. And the conversation was very rich. And the possibility of us building a broader movement was discussed. That was in May. Much of the summer, I spent my time, that was the summer of 2006, I spent my time doing research of DOD directives. I got some information from Thomas Barton of the Military Project, and I just started doing some research and found these directives. You know, there were several of them. I used to know the numbers by hand. I think one is 1325.6 that goes over the actual what governs political activity in the military. But the basic crux of the appeal is this. Or what became the appeal is this. One, and Angie mentioned it earlier, as long as you're off base, out of uniform, and not speaking ill will of the president, that's a kind of a gray area. you can, and you have to be within the United States. You can be involved in political demonstrations. You can go to political meetings. There's even guidelines that says that you can even write op-eds and things of that nature as long as you're not using military equipment or on a military base. And so the appeal itself, the actual writing of an appeal to a congressperson, that comes from the Military Whistleblower Protection Act, which says that any member of the United States military without prior command approval can send a written appeal communication to their member of Congress on any issue. Mm-hmm. That's the base of it. That's the basis of the appeal for redress. And so once we got into the legal language of it, then we brought on the Center for Conscience and War, a lady by the name of J.E. McNeil, who does a lot of counseling through the GI Rights Hotline, helping people understand their rights, particularly around conscientious objection, what have you. We understood that the military says military members can't petition. So it was a play on words, really. We didn't say petition because they say we can't petition. So we said, but we can't appeal. We actually used the word appeal, got some attorneys to look at it. And by the time we got to the end of September, 1st of October, we kind of had a framework we were working with. David was, if you look at the appeal itself, the language of the appeal, it has a patriotic ethos to it. That's totally David right there. Because David was adamant about the appeal having a patriotic ethos and also being somewhat non-ideological and able to attract a broad range of military members, from those who might be ideological to those who may be the most patriotic, but they're on their third or fourth tour in Iraq and they're just sick and tired and just ready to go home, what have you.
The appeal itself is basically to stay out of Iraq and Afghanistan, essentially. Is that correct?
Yeah, the actual appeal is for us to end the occupations and to bring the troops home.
How was that received by people?
Say again?
How was that received by people? How was that message? What kind of feedback did you get from that?
From the military people.
Oh, you mean from the higher ups?
From the military and people in your command and the public at large.
So when we first initiated the appeal, the three active duty people on the task force, because we had what was known as an appeal for redress task force, was comprised of your leading, you know, veterans peace organizations like Veterans for Peace, Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Military Families Speak Out, the Center for Conscience and War. And so what we did was we decided that myself, I was based in the Norfolk area, Liam Madden, who was a Marine, was based in Quantico, Virginia, and then my friend Lindsey Burnett was based in Fort Campbell, Kentucky with the 101st Airborne. We decided that we would go out and test the appeal among our immediate, you know, friends and network. What we found was a resounding, not just appreciation, but endorsement.
Hmm.
A resounding endorsement of the appeal. I must have went out on a weekend and got about 24 people to sign the appeal.
Wow.
I was talking to people just around Norfolk. Most of the people I knew, some people I bumped into.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, hey, what y'all think about this? And people just signed up, you know?
Yeah.
So from there, I had gotten in contact with the Navy Times and had talked about the idea of writing an op-ed and connecting it to the open appeal that was done by active duty in 1969. So the Navy Times was totally on board with that. And so we decided that late October would be the launch of the appeal for redress. It must have been late October 2006. And the launch was based on an op-ed that I wrote in the Navy Times, launching the appeal for redress. And so the signatures, and then we launched the website, and the signatures started to come in. Once we got up to about 600 signatures, approximately 624, that's when we heard from both 60 Minutes and Nation Magazine simultaneously. a writer from Nation named Mark Cooper, and we heard from 60 Minutes at the same time.
So can you tell the audience what the names of those articles are, or the title of the 60 Minutes program?
Okay, yeah. So you can go to YouTube and pull up that 60 Minutes program. Give me a second. The article that was in Nation magazine, it was written by Mark Cooper. The name of that article is called About Face, the Growing Anti-War Movement Within the Military, which was published in January. It was either published in December of 2006 or January 2007. It was right around that time. Early on that time frame.
Jonathan, I think we're actually, unfortunately, we're running out of time, which is terrible. But we might have to ask you to come back again or something.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. This hour went so fast, and we got like 20 more questions that we want to ask you.
I know. I have like all my underlined parts of the book.
So how can people get a hold of you?
How can I get a hold of me? Well, the best way to get a hold of me is through you all.
Okay. That's fine.
You can get a hold of me through Angie or yourself.
Okay, sounds great.
The 60 Minutes program is called Appeal for Redress on 60 Minutes, February 2007. I'll put my email out there. People can email me.
Okay, go ahead.
People can email me at jhutchell77@yahoo.com.
Great. Sounds great.
Your book was so awesome, Anti-War Soldier, How to Dissent Within the Ranks of the Military. It's such a good book.
Right.
Jonathan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you a lot, buddy.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Okay,
you
bye.
Peace.
That was a great, I think that the book, you know, if you have anybody that's in the military, any of your family member or friends in the military, you should get this book. And Angie gave me mine, and I read it probably in 2 days.
Because mm-hmm. Very easy read. It's packed full of information, and you will learn so many things in there.
Yeah. It's Anti-War Soldiers, How to Dissent Within the Ranks of the Military by Jonathan W. Huttu Sr. And it's easy reading. It's really, really great. But also, if you're really interested in something like this, you can also put David Courtright if you're on the internet, you can put David Courtright, Courtright, and see a whole bunch of stuff by him, because he was very, really active during the Vietnam War, you know. And I remember when he brought up, when Jonathan brought up about the Stop Our Ship, I remember reading, because I got out of the Army in 68, so, you know. And I remember reading about the Navy guys down in San Diego really fighting it, really fighting their ships. And guys were going, you know, leaving their ships and refusing to go back on them. And a lot of them went to churches. A lot of these guys went to churches and, you know, refused to go back on their ships. And there were... There was this whole movement within the military because of the Vietnam War, and guys in Vietnam refusing to fight. That's how big stuff.
Stop Loss actually came about, because so many people were leaving, so many soldiers and sailors in the Vietnam War were leaving that they literally had to stop the loss of people leaving, and that's how Stop Loss came about.
For you guys, right? For you
and
guys,
well, 80 people don't know this, but 80,000 soldiers and sailors have been stop loss since the Iraq War.
That's just amazing.
80,000.
That's amazing. Because, you know, guys thought, men and women thought they did their duty, and they're home and got jobs and families and everything. All of a sudden, they get this thing in the mail saying you got to go back into the military.
They never let you leave to begin with.
Yeah, they never
let you leave. They just extend your time.
Right. Right. And I was going to bring up one more thing. We only got a couple minutes, Tammy. And Tammy Dean is going to Vietnam Wednesday.
Woo!
Yeah, I wish I could go with her. It'll be so much fun.
You can interview me when I get back.
Yeah, we'll interview her when she comes back. So you're listening to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon. I'm Marvin with Angie.
Hello.
Hello. And we'll be back Friday, March 17th at 9 a.m. And there it is.
At the end of the early British wars, the young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I or I march to the battles of the German.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Underground Grad School. Classes that begin in March include Introduction to Music Theory, A Moment of Possibility, Finding Opportunity in Our Differences, Financial Freedom, Getting Empowered About Money in Your Life, and more. Portland Underground Grad School is also known as PUGS. Classes take place all over Portland metro area. Information about registering, teaching classes, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.